Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. My name is Linda Meeks, and I am the host for today. And I would like to welcome Laura Bates and Rachel LaPonce to the podcast. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you for having us, Linda.
Hi, Linda. Thank you.
So today, our podcast is a podcast that is focusing on a discussion about hospice palliative care nursing in a diverse world. And we will be looking at how to increase inclusivity of patients and their families who identify as LGBTQIAP+ and/or identify as a part of a sexual gender minority group. In order to provide good quality hospice palliative care to our patients, our approach must be patient and family-centered, and in order to do this, we must be able to identify and address potential and actual issues in all domains. On top of this, effective and open communication is vital between the patient and their family and their healthcare team. Rachel, can you explain why this topic was chosen?
I sure can. Thanks, Linda. And I'll just make note that sexual gender minorities is quite a, it's the long version. And so for the purpose of me describing or Linda, you can use this acronym as well. Laura, you can as well. I'm just going to say SGM to represent sexual gender minorities, if that works.
Sure. And I think Laura will go into some more of the acronyms a little bit later in the podcast as well.
I think she will. Yeah, that's great. So we've chosen to speak about this topic for two main reasons. The first reason is that access to quality hospice palliative care is considered a human right, though throughout much of the world. Despite this, there are significant barriers to prevent those who do not fall into the typical population demographics, which makes it very challenging. The second reason is that high quality hospice palliative care is patient and family centered. In order to provide that kind of care, healthcare providers must be comfortable with addressing biases and stigmas in order to advocate for their patients. In order to do this well, and as healthcare providers, we must be able to self-reflect and be aware of our own biases that impact the care that we are providing.
That's right, Rachel. And before we begin, let's go through some definitions and explain some of the terms that you might hear throughout this discussion. So LGBTQIAP+ is an acronym that stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender or transsexual, queer or questioning, intersex, asexual, pansexual, and other individuals. The World Health Organization defines sexuality as a central aspect that involves thought, desire, attitude, fantasy, values, conduct, gender roles, sexual orientation, intimate relationships, and/or reproduction. Often you'll hear in popular culture gender and sex being interchanged and meaning the same things, but they actually don't. Gender is defined as a set of characteristics linked to the personal experience of masculinity and/or femininity. And someone's gender identity consists of how that person subjectively feels and identifies themselves in relation to gender models, and it may be in line with the gender assigned at birth based on their sex or phenotype or not. When that gender identity matches, the term is that's used is cisgender. When the identities do not match, the term used is transgender. Sexual orientation refers to the attraction, behavior, and desire of a person in relation to another in terms of an affective sexual relationship. And SGM, or sexual and gender minority group, refers to any or though and all individuals who identify as falling outside of the cis heteronormative sexual pattern with which most of the population identifies with.
Thanks, Laura. First of all, can we start by discussing what is currently known about the inequalities facing the LGBTQIAP+ population? Rachel, what does being a member of the SGM group mean in terms of overall health and access to healthcare?
Some of those in our listening audience might wonder how being a member of a SGM group would put someone at a health disadvantage. In fact, members of minority groups experience disadvantage in both accessing and receiving healthcare throughout their lives, and this does not change when looking at hospice palliative care. In fact, they're almost one and the same. For SGM individuals, there's reduced access to healthcare, discrimination experienced in all healthcare settings. This creates a higher rate of chronic illness, higher rates of mortality from chronic medical conditions. These individuals are more likely to rate their health as poor when compared to heterosexuals. They also have more chronic conditions and a higher prevalence of disabilities. Some types of cancers are more prevalent in people who are homosexual than people who are heterosexual. SGM individuals are less likely to access routine screening, which means they are much more likely to present with more advanced illness at the time of diagnosis. In addition, SGM individuals are 2.5 times more likely to experience depression, anxiety, and substance use and misuse. And research shows this is only partially due to the history of discrimination and stigma. I found one study by Rodriguez and colleagues published in 2023 discussed the effects of minority stress on SGM populations. Minority stress is the compound effect of stigma and discrimination against an individual or a specific population. For SGM individuals, a history of rejection, homophobia, social exclusion from community, compounded with higher rates of drug and alcohol abuse, creates a higher risk for the development of certain types of cancers when compared to the general population. In someone who identifies as SGM, they also are structurally vulnerable. The difficulty with accessing timely and appropriate healthcare is compounded. Another study from 2019 examined barriers to accessing healthcare for structurally vulnerable populations at end of life. And they found that structurally vulnerable populations have relatively fewer social supports. They often die alone in less than ideal places, such as shelters, transitional housing, or even in fact on the streets. And if they do access hospice palliative care at all, it's very late in their illness, almost at the stage of end of life. This particular study also discussed that the majority of current hospice palliative care programs and policies are largely designed to support the normative palliative population, people who fall within the dominant group and those with a cancer diagnosis. The authors of this study described it perfectly when they said blanket policies fail to recognize diversity, such as lack of access to basic daily requirements for survival, and not considering who needs that kind of support. This statement is also applicable for SGM individuals. When paperwork contains terms such as husband or wife, instead of spouse or partner or significant other, or asks for family members who are involved in care instead of names of support people, we enforce stigma and continue to discriminate. When a patient does not fit within these terms, they really don't know how to respond and may in fact leave those blanks.
That's right, Rachel. Let's talk a bit more about stigma and discrimination. Even with all of the education that healthcare providers receive during their initial training and ongoing throughout their careers on diversity, inclusion, cultural safety, and about examining one's own biases and beliefs, stigma and discrimination still happens in healthcare on a regular basis. And I would even say on a daily basis for some populations.
Absolutely.
What does the literature say about this, Linda?
Presence and effect of stigma and discrimination is well researched in the scientific literature. The benefits of education on both the patient and the healthcare provider regarding diversity are also well researched. It is well documented that the presence of stigma is a barrier to health-seeking behaviors, engagement in healthcare, and adherence to treatment across a wide range of health conditions. The discrimination occurs because of the stigma associated with a specific disease or because of the population the patient identifies as belonging to. One Canadian study by Wilson, Cortez, Miller, and Snitchcomb looked specifically at the lived experience of older SGM individuals within the Ontario healthcare system. So this was a great find because obviously we live in Ontario. They found that the participants felt invisible in the healthcare system and feared having to hide their sexuality in order to receive appropriate care, especially if they required care in an institutional setting. For many of the participants, there was a huge fear that they would be forced back in the closet, so to speak, in order to receive the same level of care as a heterosexual counterpart. The age demographics of the participants meant that they grew up during a time in Canadian society where same-sex relationships were often hidden and even considered illegal. One participant was quoted in the study as saying they would rather die than go back into hiding their true identity. The participants also spoke about the compounded issue of sexuality and sexual expression being a taboo topic in later life in institutionalized settings, on top of having minority status due to gender identity or sexual orientation. There was great concern about who would advocate for them if and when they were unable to advocate for themselves anymore. There's more and more research being done on health-related stigma occurring along with other stigmas such as sexual orientation and gender, without taking into account the compounding effect of these intersection stigmas, their full effect on the health outcomes of the patient cannot be fully appreciated.
I absolutely
agree.
That's so sad. I know it really is. And that's why, you know, there really has to be more attention put towards it, more funding for research. You know, one area that has received a lot of recent attention and funding for research put into it is the experience of LGBTQ IAP plus patients who have been diagnosed with cancer. Sexuality is something that must be discussed when looking after cancer patients or palliative patients in general. As the diagnosis and treatment of cancer or any other life-limiting illness tends to get worse, there appears to be a negative impact on sexual desire, sexual satisfaction, sexual health in general, on top of the physical, mental, and spiritual changes that a life-limiting diagnosis brings. What does some of this research show us, though, Laura?
So I specifically found a study by Rodriguez and colleagues that looked at the impact of a cancer diagnosis and treatment on the lives of people who identified as SGM. In the study, they identified that people in SGM groups have unique challenges and barriers to accessing cancer care due to discrimination and stigma by healthcare providers. This issue is compounded, however, when someone is trans or who does not present specifically as male or female. The stigma and discrimination prevents appropriate access to cancer screening and testing in a timely fashion. The study also found that SGM cancer patients have specific psychosocial challenges, including higher levels of anxiety, depression, and suicide, and thus may have a worse response to treatments. Because cancer treatment, as you said, Rachel, can impact sexuality and sexual function, regardless of gender or sexual orientation, the approaches used to explore and treat these issues needs to be individualized according not just to each group, but each patient specifically.
I so agree, Laura. Like individualized care planning is really what is key there.
Exactly. Another study by Bristow and colleagues described the additional challenges that someone faces who is transsexual or transgendered and is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, especially if the type of cancer that they have been diagnosed with goes against their gender identity, such as if you're trans male and you're diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Some of the participants in that study spoke of the struggles they have experienced in balancing the needs of their cancer treatment with the desire to either have gender-conforming surgery or the interactions that occur between the hormone therapies which support their gender identity and the interaction with the treatment for their disease or a side effect of their treatments. One participant was quoted as saying that they were taking estrogen to support their gender identity, but it had caused blood clots. And the decision they had to make was between their psychological health of continuing with the estrogen treatment to maintain their gender identity, or risking their physical health because of the risk that blood clots carry and the impact that it was having on the treatment of their lung disease.
Such a decision to have to make, I could not imagine.
Me neither. I couldn't imagine having to make such a big decision and knowing that both of those carry risks, both physically and psychologically.
Absolutely.
This study also spoke about the needs, the additional needs that SGM populations have in terms of social needs and support when facing a life-limiting diagnosis. They described heightened stress and isolation due to family estrangements and limited social support from friends or chosen family, both during the illness journey and after death in bereavement. The participants spoke about disenfranchised grief and the lack of language to describe some losses, stating that there was less validation of the loss of a life partner versus someone saying that they had lost their spouse or their husband or wife, because there is no term in the common language for a bereaved partner who is of same sex, like there is for a widow or a widower. In addition, for the trans population specifically, there's additional stress that their death certificate might not match their gender identity or currently used name if they have not taken the steps to have these things changed legally. This study was from the United Kingdom, and it spoke of something that is available there called a gender recognition certificate. Some of the participants were worried that that certificate would not come in time before their death, and therefore their death certificate would not match their gender identity or name, because it would go with their legal name from birth and their legal gender from birth. In the studies that we all read in preparation for the discussion, almost all of them spoke about the simple fact that healthcare providers and healthcare services don't often ask for simple demographic information such as sexuality or gender identity, and how inclusive that simple act can be. By asking everyone about their sexuality and gender identity, it allows patients the chance to disclose this information in a less pressured way. It allows healthcare providers to be more comfortable in asking those types of questions to all of their patients. And it prompts the healthcare providers to use more inclusive terms or ask for pronouns and terms of choice from the patients themselves. It enforces the point that in order to provide person-centered care that is aligned with the needs of that patient, one must actually know their patient and their individual circumstances.
As you're talking about this, Laura, I'm just sitting here reflecting about, I'll speak about nursing because we're all nurses, how we believe that we provide person-centered care, but when you're actually giving the scenarios, it makes one reflect about, have we been? Because I've never actually even reflected on this, if I'm being true, or actually had the experience of having had one of these things happen in my environment. So it's very eye-opening.
I do think too that the policies and processes that are in place that allow us to do our job before we're even front-facing individuals creates barriers and starts discriminating from the point of intake before they're even connected to an individual. And if the way that we're connecting with individuals or allowing them to break into the system or get some assistance creates barriers and prevents them from feeling included, then they're just going to shut it down and avoid trying to get any. So from the perspective of from an organizational perspective, it's important for us to have policies and processes in place from the intake point, from the point of the website, that ensures there's inclusion and that there's no discrimination, so that there are no barriers for every individual who deserves quality palliative care has the opportunity to get into the system to receive that essential care. The paperwork, as I'm saying, sometimes is the barrier right from
exactly.
The beginning.
Exactly. And imagine if you don't feel safe filling out a form, how unsafe you would be speaking about some of these topics in person with a healthcare provider.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, Laura, what about adolescents and young adults who identify as SGM? How does a cancer diagnosis affect them?
Well, it's funny you ask that because I found a paper published just last year that looked at the experience of SGM adolescents and young adults who had been diagnosed with cancer specifically, and found that there seemed to be a lot of similarities between this population and older adults, but also some great differences that we need to take into account. One of the biggest concerns with this younger demographic is that they are at a time in their development where their identity is not completely formed yet. And they are often exploring, establishing, and still trying to articulate their sexuality or gender identity, along with their place in relationships and communities around them. This makes them very vulnerable to the disruption that comes with a diagnosis of cancer or another life-limiting illness. In addition, they have a relative lack of healthcare system experience and knowledge, and often have lower levels of health literacy, which compounds the difficulty in finding appropriate support or information. Some of the participants in this study talked about how often the activities for exploring their sexuality or gender identity became off limits because of their diagnosis or treatment. One participant in particular talked about how much they felt, what they felt of the activities, saying that typically exploring their sexuality or gender identity would take place in places such as nightclubs, parties, or social events, but their cancer treatment meant that those situations were difficult or even impossible to access sometimes. Another participant was quoted as saying, "I don't feel the queer community is overly disability friendly," when speaking about their post-surgery pain and how it impacted even years later their involvement in the community. This study also talks about the impact of having surgery on reproductive organs and the effect of that on body image and body dysmorphia, along with the impact of internalized prejudice. And that's something that not a lot of the studies talked about, was that internalized prejudice. Some participants noted that cancer treatment and its effects on sexual function meant that they also questioned what it meant for their sexual orientation. Many participants had not disclosed their gender or sexual identity to their friends or family, and were even more reluctant to disclose it to healthcare providers. Some feared that their healthcare provider would out them to family and friends who came to appointments. This increased the level of shame or self-prejudice. Like the taboo also of not discussing sexuality with elder generations, healthcare providers are even more reluctant to discuss sexuality, gender identity, and even fertility with younger people facing a life-limiting illness. And this leads to unmet needs, especially around sexual function and fertility. In just like the studies that focus on adults, adolescents and young adults also found that cancer information is focused on cisgendered and heterosexual populations. This leads to an increased feeling of invisibility. Precarious social support is also a concern for this younger population because of social isolation, and the impact of prejudice, the difficulty in calling on support from the LGBT community that they may not be fully connected with yet. They don't necessarily have an intimate partner who can provide them with support. And the absence of things like cancer peer support networks that are specifically geared for young LGBT people. It makes it very difficult to find your way in the world when you have all of these issues preventing your identity development.
Absolutely. It's a mountain that needs to be climbed, and we're at the base.
And as we know, remember from our conference, when we had one of our speakers discussing about sexuality, and she was in a heterosexual relationship and the difficulty that she had. So when you look at the base of even that, you can see how difficult it is for these people.
That's, we definitely have work to do.
Yeah, for sure. I wonder, and some questions come to mind is, and Laura, maybe you can answer this. How do we ensure research and the interventions or some of the findings of this research are put into policy and put into practice, you know, in order to account for some of the effects and the stigma on health outcomes for our patients?
Well, there's a wonderful framework that was developed by Stengel and colleagues called the Health Stigma and Discrimination Framework, Rachel. They published a paper on it in 2019. This framework emphasizes the broader social, cultural, political, and economical forces that structure stigma and shows the interconnections between power and vulnerability. It is an awesome framework that can be used to analyze the stigmas and discrimination that are impacting your population that you're studying to ensure that all of these things are taken into account. So this framework demonstrates that stigma experiences and practices influence the affected population as well as the organizations and institutions that serve these populations. These together influence the overall health and social impact. The framework allows multi-level interventions to be used to respond to health-related stigmas. And the authors said it best when they concluded their paper with the following quote, "People are not defined by just one disease or one perceived difference. They have complex realities in which to maneuver in order to protect their health and well-being." And I love that quote because it reminds us that our patient is not just a patient with a life-limiting illness, but they have social, economical, and psychosocial factors that are affecting their journey through this.
I absolutely love it as well. And I'll even say it again because I love it so much. I honestly think when you say, you know, what was your aha moment or what was your pearl? What was your takeaway? You know, I'll just say it again because I just want, you know, people listening to kind of remember it. People are not defined by just one disease or one perceived difference. They have complex realities in which to maneuver in order to protect their health and well-being. And, you know, it's kind of along the lines of, you know, everybody comes to the table with different issues. And yes, the table is meant to discuss certain things, but you can't discuss those certain things without addressing what that person comes to the table with as well. And we have no idea the complexities and the realities of different individuals. And so we need to kind of place our agenda to the side to incorporate some of those complexities to make sure that we're addressing them, so that the care that we're providing, that palliative approach to care that's so essential, that's to be holistic. We can't, in fact, say it's holistic and if we're not addressing their complex realities.
Exactly. And it means...
Oh, go ahead, Laura.
I was going to say, it means that we have to attack multiple problems at the same time sometimes.
Absolutely. And I was going to say, it just reminded me of some of those videos that we used to see where the title says, "Be kind to someone," because you don't know what kind of day that they've had. And then they go back in the video in say it's the afternoon, and then they go back to the morning, and it progresses through the kind of day that the person's had. And it really makes you stop and think.
Exactly.
So what can we actually do as healthcare providers to ensure we are supporting inclusivity for those who identify as sexual and gender minorities?
When you hear what the literature says, it sounds relatively simple, but as we know, it is not, for a multitude of reasons, whether it's the political climate, the structure of the healthcare system, or just the fact that not everybody is open to learning and growing in their practice. I found one study where the authors reviewed existing literature and developed a comprehensive list of recommendations that I thought would be good to share with everybody. And they divided it up into different areas depending on what the impact was geared towards. So at the clinical practice level, some of the things that can be done to increase inclusivity include ensuring that the data collected at initial encounters include sexual orientation and gender identity, ensure that discussions and formalization of substitute decision making happening early, and that I think goes for anybody with a life-limiting illness. And they even suggest that it's ideal to happen at the initial patient encounter. Also at the clinical practice level, they talk about screening for psychosocial distress, suicide risk, financial planning, and relationships with both the family of origin and family of choice. And finally, making sure that there's acknowledgement that reconciliation with family of origin may or may not be welcomed. And it sounds awful to think of a healthcare provider trying to force a patient to reconcile with their blood family, but it does happen. and is documented in some of these studies. At the organizational level, the recommendations made include mandatory in-services and education for employees to facilitate their ability to provide appropriate SGM-centered care, giving healthcare providers access to tools to allow them to assess and work through their own biases in regards to groups other than their own, ensure that healthcare providers have information on resources for SGM patients and their families, and that it's included in all materials provided, including things like welcome packets, material available in the waiting rooms or examination rooms. They also suggest that organizations should have statements of policy that convey absolutely no tolerance for discrimination or the promotion of conversion therapy. And finally, they suggest that policies and procedures must ensure there is screening for and addressing the disenfranchised grief of surviving SGM spouses and partners. At the research level, the recommendations state that there is a further need for studies to fill in the gaps of knowledge in regards to how morbidity and mortality of SGM patients differ from the general population. That for future research collects demographic characteristics such as sexual orientation and gender identity, and that there's continued outreach with SGM patients and advocacy or support groups to better understand the factors that might impact future studies and what should be considered priority areas of research in the future. And at the educational level, the recommendations reinforce the need for ongoing training for all front-facing hospice palliative care providers, including chaplains or those in psychosocial support roles, to ensure cultural competence, and specifically that it includes training on how to take a sexual history and how to identify sexual orientation and gender identity, and how to explore non-faith-based spirituality. Additionally, there needs to be more inclusive education regarding advanced care planning and substitute decision-making rights based on the laws of the province that they reside in regards to unmarried partners. This paper came from the United States, where the legal rights of unmarried spouses or partners varies greatly state from state. But I do know in Ontario that anyone who's considered in a common law relationship has the same rights for substitute decision maker as the married partner or spouse.
Very interesting. When I was doing some research for this as well, I also found some additional research that suggested that one of the most important things that can be done on an organizational level is to ensure that all healthcare providers are given ongoing training in cultural competence that includes LGBTQIAP plus sexuality, relationships, and other population-specific issues. We already do anti-bullying workshops. We already do workshops for Indigenous cultural safety related to French language and the Francophone communities. The LGBTQIAP and sexuality cultural inclusivity workshops need to be included as part of that organizational competencies for all employees.
Right, I agree, Rachel.
Yeah, and we have done ours. We have done our training.
And I think it's fabulous that our organization is doing some of these recommendations already in order to make sure that we are as inclusive and accepting as possible. And we don't think of sexuality or gender as falling under cultural competency training, but it does. I also found another paper by Bristow and colleagues from 2018, and they had a list of 10 relatively low-cost recommendations that organizations could implement.
I'd love to hear them.
And we know in healthcare, low cost always gets everybody's attention.
Oh, yes. Yes. We're listening.
So they divide it into two categories. And the first category is at the individual level. So these five recommendations are things that anybody can do, no matter where they practice. And that's one, to avoid using heterosexually framed or assumption-laden language. Two, to demonstrate sensitivity and exploration of sexual orientation or gender history. Three, to respect individuals' preferences regarding disclosure of sexual identity or gender history. Four, to carefully explore intimate relationships and significant others, including biological and chosen family or friends. And five, explicitly including partners and/or significant others in healthcare decisions and discussions. The other category that they put the recommendations under is at the service or institutional level. These are: one, to make clear statements of policies and procedures related to discrimination; two, to ensure that content regarding LGBT communities in the training on diversity and discrimination is included; three, to include LGBT visibility in materials, both written and in images; four, to provide explicit markers of inclusion, such as rainbow lanyards or pin badges; and five, to initiate partnerships and engagement with LGBT community groups in their area. It sounds so simple.
I do have a question, Laura, and you know, answer it if you know. Otherwise, I'll do some additional research myself. But you know, I often see rainbow paraphernalia around, you know, and logos and things like that. And I've often wondered, I'm supportive. In wearing it, am I showing support, or in wearing it, am I identifying, or is it both? Because you did mention, you know, one of the things that we could do is, you know, having a pin or a badge or wearing a rainbow lanyard for our name badges. In doing that, is it identifying that our organization is supportive and without bias and inclusive to the group, rather than identifying, personally identifying as a part of it myself?
It is either or both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. So there are people who identify as a part of the SGM minority who use the rainbow visual as a way of introducing themselves and providing that visual cue that they do not follow the, you know, cis heteronormative typical stereotypical that others might assume based on how they look. It is also a sign of allyship and of support. And I believe that if organizations or individuals even who are promoting their allyship or support by using these visual aids, that they actually are walking the walk behind the talk, so to speak. That you shouldn't be using it unless you are fully engaged and fully willing to advocate and to have some of these more uncomfortable conversations.
And I find my own personal experiences when you meet or greet or see someone that does display the rainbow sign, it's actually a conversation opener.
I agree.
But to point out that you can't look to outward symbols, outward examples that someone would like to be asked the questions, we need to purposefully ask the questions and introduce the conversation so that it could be open and forthcoming. It's up to us to ask the questions, not wait for them to bring it forward to our attention.
Exactly, exactly. But from what I've read, having some sort of visual cue, whether it's a sticker on a window at the entrance or something similar, you know, maybe at the reception desk, that just lets people know that this is a safer space than it might appear on first glance, and that there are people here who will be safe to disclose to.
That's great information. Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
So, Rachel, how can healthcare providers better communicate with their patients about sexuality in a hospice palliative care setting? Many healthcare providers are uncomfortable with having these types of conversations with their patients in general. So, the literature also shows that many healthcare providers are even more uncomfortable with having these types of conversations when their patient's sexuality is different than their own.
So I absolutely agree, Linda, that many healthcare providers are uncomfortable having these types of conversations with their patients. So there are a few models. suggested in literature that can be used to be icebreakers to help lead the conversations on sexuality. So two that I'd like to mention. One is called the Better Model, BETTER, and the other one is the Plissit Model, PLISSIT. So both of these models are structured to help healthcare providers start conversations with patients about sexuality and its importance in overall quality of life. So each model has been shown in literature to have a positive effect on the patient-professional communication exchange. So regardless of the professional's knowledge about sexuality or sexuality-related issues, the models help guide the conversation to ensure that all those key points are targeted. The models do this by contributing to a relationship of trust between the professional and the patient. They're guidelines.
Thanks for that
information.
It's nice
to have. I love having guidelines when I'm having a conversation that is maybe a little bit awkward for some people to have.
Absolutely. And when we think of guidelines that we often use in palliative care, we can think of the Canadian critical illness conversations. That's a phenomenal tool to introduce advanced care planning and goals of care conversations with patients who have a life-limiting illness. And that template or the template used for that Canadian critical illness conversation is a template and guidelines of actual statements that are purposeful and help you transition in conversations with your patient who has a life-limiting illness to make sure that you're meeting all those categories that you should be touching on.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you mentioned that,
and you don't
Rachel.
You don't need to use them forever either.
Right.
Pardon?
This is my aha moment. Though I've never heard of those models. I'll just openly say that. And I have been involved in accreditation for person and family-centered care in many, many organizations and in recent years. And the mandate was obviously to do person-centered care. And I can tell you that probably was very lacking in this area, even for accreditation.
Yeah.
Sexuality is such a taboo subject in healthcare.
In most westernized healthcare systems, equity and access to hospice palliative care is a mandate. We know that. In addition, access to hospice palliative care is increasingly recognized as an essential human right around the world. It is vital that all healthcare providers utilize approaches which take into account how social determinants of health influence access to hospice palliative care for SGM individuals. Ultimately, all discussions regarding sexuality with patients should be done in a respectful and supportive manner. However, there is still much work to be done to ensure that it is inclusive of a wide variety of sexualities and genders. As Rodriguez and colleagues put it best in their paper, sexual orientation, gender identity, and expression are integral aspects of a person's identity. And everyone has the right to express themselves and their sexuality in an authentic and satisfying way.
So true.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have to be sure that someone's identification and the authentic way in which they're expressing themselves does not create a barrier to receiving the essential palliative care that is deserving of absolutely everyone.
Exactly.
And it has been in the past, and we need to be change agents in addressing, reflecting, being aware so that we can move things forward to break down some of these barriers to care for some of these marginalized, vulnerable populations.
Well, it's the beginning of 2024, and we're constantly looking for education opportunities. And I think that we've probably spoken today about one that we can advocate and help to take on.
I agree.
So I want to thank both of you for joining me in the discussion today, as usual. Even though with our experience in hospice palliative care, there's always an opportunity for more learning and to advocate for people who we take care of. So thank you very much.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
us.
Thank you, Rachel and Linda.
Thank you, Laura Linda.